Welcome to PhilosopherRock.com, a podcast series that explores the philosophies and worldviews of rock and roll. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the presenters unless otherwise stated. Sometimes your host will say things that do not align with your views or those of the artists reviewed here, and as such, they remain the host's opinion expressed in good faith for your entertainment, enlightenment, and edification. So now, let's join GK and Brian as they attempt to analyze and evaluate the messages and lyrics and lives of your favorite rockers.
Well, welcome to Philosopher Rock, the show where a couple of fossils look at rock. This is episode 4 of the show, and we continue our discussion about Jethro Tull, and specifically the worldview of Ian Anderson. This is part 2 of a two-parter concerning Jethro Tull, so if you haven't heard part 1, you can find that at www.philosopherrock.com. That's our website, www.philosopherrock.com. Or you can find us on YouTube. And don't forget, when you do find us, remember to like and subscribe. Also, if you want to contact us with your compliments, you can email us at philosopherrock@gmail.com. philosopherrock@gmail.com. Okay, so let's get to the show. We're going to continue to offer more quotes from Ian Anderson. We're also going to examine a few more songs by Jethro Tull. We're going to offer some tidbits as we go along about the band. And we will continue to discuss philosophy and more. Their philosophy, our philosophy, everyone's philosophy. So without further introduction, this is episode 4 of Philosopher Rock with your hosts, GK and Brian. Alrighty, let's kick off this episode with some words from the man himself, Ian Anderson. And of course, you can go and find this on YouTube by hitting the link that will be on the blog section of our website.
The song was Aqualung. The year was 1971. I'm Ian Anderson from Jethro Tull, and these are the sounds of the time.
The 1970s have been called a decade of transition, and perhaps nowhere is that more evident than in music. After all, this is the generation that gave us punk, disco, and the height of progressive rock. The sound was experimental, and the concepts tended toward the artistic. Few bands rode the wave of the moment more than Jethro Tull.
It was the beginning of that era of improvised music slipping into the popular format. So it came via blues, it came via black American blues, and it had impacted upon a whole generation of young, middle-class, white British boys, most of whom went to art colleges.
The sound, born in the late stages of the psychedelic 60s, would embody the experimental nature of the 70s. The same decade that would see the questioning of authority become the norm. From college campuses to the White House also saw musicians straying far from rock's roots in search of that new sound.
We were enamored of this rather loose, slightly rebellious, and very free-flowing music that just seemed to erupt from the soul.
The 70s also meant changing some of the most basic rules of rock, from the length of a song to the signature, even that rock staple of a guitar front and center.
I was like many of my teenage peers back in the mid-60s. You know, I wanted to be an electric guitar player. I mean, that was the sexy thing to do. Everybody wanted to play, you know, a Fender Strat or a Gibson Les Paul and be a guitar hero.
Jethro Tull was the name of an 18th century British agriculturalist. He had no real meaning for Ian Anderson and his bandmates, yet it stuck. Whatever they called themselves, By the time the 60s gave way to the 70s, the band, once called the New Cream, had developed their own sound, and it started with a flute.
The flute was a choice, not because it was particularly thought through. It was just hanging on the wall of a music store, and I had my battered Fender Stratocaster and part exchanged it for a flute and a Shure Unidyne 3 microphone. And those two things, the flute and the microphone, served me over the next year or two in establishing Jethro Tull as a band with some emerging and growing popularity.
Even if Anderson admits his finger placement on the flute was wrong until the 1990s, the instrument would take the lead on the band's biggest commercial success, the 1971 album Aqualung.
The very beginning of Aqualung, not that it's played on the flute, but it was the classic guitar line, and that began by me playing that on acoustic guitar. On acoustic guitar, in a holiday inn bedroom, trying not to wake up anybody in the room next door. But in my head, it was da-da-da-da-da-da. So when I, then ran through that and showed the notes and the chords to Martin Barr, it became immediately something different.
Jethro Tull's sound would continue to evolve with the times. As the 70s came to a close and progressive rock lost its place on the radio, they would shift closer to the folk rock sound, finding that success in music tends to shift with the tastes and the times.
Well, inspiration is it is a mixture of inspiration, that sense of suddenly the time is right and you're visited by the muse. It's not something you choose to do, but you just have this creative moment, a creative flush, and that's nice when it happens. But I think more often than not, more than 50% of the time, you've actually got to go out and meet the muse halfway, because if you don't step outside of yourself and your comfort zone and go looking for that inspiration, it's probably not going to come.
Okay, here's a fun fact for you. Did you know that Tony Iommi of Black Sabbath was a temporary member of Jethro Tull in 1968? It is a fact that he was, but as far as I know, he did not record anything with the band. I just find that interesting, especially if you're a progressive rock, hard rock, heavy metal fan. It's interesting to know. Okay, to another quote from the man himself, and I find this one quite interesting, as it has to do with how many of us choose to listen to music the way that we do these days. It'll become clearer what I mean as I read this for you. So he was asked, "You've been playing music for over 50 years now. What is your perspective on the way listening to music has changed across the years?" And Anderson replied, "I think that people have got used to hearing a low quality of music and accepting it for what it is, essentially listening to highly compressed digital formats and often not discrete environments. You're listening to music while you're in the car or on an airplane or going to work on the train. You're listening to music filtered through this background noise, and people seem to accept hearing music that way. As a writer and a composer and a producer and an engineer, it doesn't feel great knowing that all they're hearing is something of very poor quality, partly because of the format, but mainly because of the circumstances in which they choose to listen. So I try to give people a choice. When we make music, it's available as a highly compressed MP3 or M4A. It's better than the old cassette used to be, but it's not even as good as a CD in terms of its technical quality. And when, of course, we record these days, 24-bit, perhaps 96 kHz sampling rate, you're hearing music that contains everything that the human ear can hear in terms of dynamics and frequency. We've got there. We have got to the limits that we need. Unless we grow new ears, technically we've got there a few years ago, in fact. So, 24-bit audio, which is not the standard that people listen to, but which is the standard that we record at, is as good as it gets." Okay, well, I found that interesting. I hope you did as well. I want to look at another quote, actually from the same article. And as I keep repeating myself, just so you know, that where we make direct reference to quotes, we will always put a link in the show notes. And the one I'm quoting from presently is actually called Interview with Ian Anderson from Jethro Tull, the Philosopher of Prog Rock. So that's pretty cool since we've decided to call our show Philosopher Rock. So this is part of the same interview. Now, what the basis of the interview is about is the release of the album Jethro Tull, The String Quartets. And so the idea of religion comes up in this, as it often does with Ian Anderson. If you notice that, if you look around, there's often quotes in and around religion, which is interesting for us as hosts doing this show, but I've always found it fascinating anyway, and I hope you do too. So the interviewer asks, I saw the album was recorded in a church. When we look at the lyrics of some of your early songs, we can detect a certain hostility towards organized religion. Do you still feel welcome in these kinds of places? Has your view of religion, especially Christianity, changed over the years? And here is Anderson's response. It was never hostility, even back then. It was critical of some aspects of organized religion, but it wasn't anti-religion or anti-Christianity. What I was trying to do was look into some of the aspects that I found distasteful. Religion being used as a tool for power and control, and also the pomp and ceremony of religion, which I find difficult. I go into Roman Catholic cathedrals quite often, and it's very impressive and very ornate, and they have this special ritual function, and I appreciate what it means to people. I don't feel the same simple spiritual relationship that I feel when I go into a Lutheran Protestant cathedral or a Church of England cathedral, where usually it's much less ornate. We don't worship the golden paintings, the glamour, the showbiz of religion. We try to get to the truth, the essential spiritual nature of it. So I find it easier to associate with Lutheran or Anglican traditions. But I'm not a Christian. I believe in the historical Jesus, Jesus of Nazareth, and not Jesus the Christ. In the sense that a Christian has to have that undying belief that Christ truly is both the Son of God and the Son of Man, as the Bible confusedly tells us, or he tells us if you believe the biblical words. I think the Bible is a very useful document. I seek reference from the Bible quite often, and on a number of occasions I have included elements of biblical stories in songs. But I think that, like all religions, it can be very dangerous as you approach it in a literal fashion. And there are very many scary things in the Bible, most of them in the Old Testament, but some of them in the New Testament too. And I have to try to keep in mind that I don't take these things too literally. I try to see the positive messages in the works of the Bible. I can see how easily people get polarized as a result of their beliefs. And I find it interesting how Brian hits a bullseye in terms of what Brian says in relation to these things that we're covering here and what Ian Anderson has just said in that direct quote. Anyway, that's going to come up shortly. I don't want to confuse the issue, but let's just move on. I want to give you another quote, more to do with music now than with religion, but we're just going to go music, religion, whatever. That's what we like to do here at Philosopher Rock. That's what we're here for, philosophy, and religion is part of philosophy, as all the world views are, so we're going to continue to do that. So let's go to another quote here from Ian Anderson. Okay, so I've located the article. I had to stop there and find the article for you. It's a different article to the previous one I just quoted. This is from Rolling Stone, and I will put a link in the show notes, from April the 1st this year, 2020. And it's about, they were asking me about his time at home because, you know, we're all sitting at home in this COVID crisis, and I think the crux of this, the thrust of this interview was about that. I liked this question, and I think you might be surprised at the response. The question was, what music do you turn to in times of crisis for solace and comfort, and why? And Ian Anderson replies, I'm not really a music listener. It's what I do. I think if I was a 747 pilot, I would probably not fly Cessnas on the weekends. I tend to listen to music sometimes on an airplane because I'm a nervous flyer, so I wouldn't make a very good captain of a 747. But it's kind of, you know, musical aspirin to keep my mind off what's going on around me. I stopped listening to music in my early 20s just because I thought I've heard enough. I think you get the point. You know, when you're travelling around, especially as I did around the USA so often and for so long, hearing incessant music in hotel lobbies, in elevators and cars and buses, the constant sound of popular and rock music. When you do it yourself for about 4 hours a night, intense musical experience, that's your sensible ration of musical noise in any one day. If I do listen to music, it tends to be mostly classical music. Handel, Beethoven, Mozart, interspersed occasionally with ZZ Top. So there you go, ZZ Top fans. He listens to Beethoven and ZZ Top. All right. Now, after this short little interlude we have here, we're going to get back to the rest of our show that I recorded earlier with Brian. So here we go.
You're listening to PhilosopherRock.com. Philosopher Rock is now available on YouTube. You can search YouTube for Philosopher Rock, or you can find a link to our channel in the blog section of our website where the show notes for this episode are posted. Just go to PhilosopherRock.com for that. Also, if you like what we are doing on Philosopher Rock, would you please take the time to subscribe to our YouTube channel? And to those who already have, thank you. Now, back to the show.
Here's one. Now, I do want to talk about religion and things of that nature, but I just found this one interesting. He was asked why he was never into drugs. And here's a good one for us all to take on board. He's not a silly man, right? He's a deep-thinking man. Don't think he's just that crazy rocker that goes and does all those crazy things. So he said, he was asked, why were you never into drugs? And he said, I don't enjoy the change of mood that comes from people who are drugged or drunk. I find it difficult to form bonds with people who are out of their brains. Spot on. I agree. And it's something for all of us to think about. All right. Now, he was asked directly, and these aren't very old interviews. Do you believe in God? I'm not a Christian. I don't do Jesus. But Christianity, like most of the world's great religions, is a good, practical moral code for living. However, there are some very nasty messages in the Bible. My laugh is the added extra there. But he said, I'll try and read that without the giggle. However, there are some very nasty messages in the Bible. That Moses guy, dangerous freak. All right. So just make of that what you will. I just want to give you some quotes so that you can decide for it. So you have the information and you know what I'm looking at as well. What is the meaning of life? To know the answer to that, you have to know the meaning of death. And I'm not sure I believe in any life after death. Life is an opportunity as well as a test. But ultimately, it's all just preparing us for the big mystery of death. That's pretty scary stuff for people like me who can't face the idea of retirement, sitting in an armchair watching repeats of Casualty until we finally pop off. He's quite a character, isn't he? But you know, you and I could make a strong argument here why we should be prepared for the afterlife. We should be have some ideas of what we're going to face. Our ideas would come from the Judeo-Christian tradition, specifically from the Bible. That's where my ideas would come from. But it isn't a bad idea to say that, to answer the question of what's the meaning of life, or what's the meaning of death, right? What is the meaning of death? And what comes afterwards? I think we all need to give some thought to that. And again, before you throw the baby out with the bathwater on this thing called Christianity, give it a good look. Don't look at the organized side of things, those organized religions, the religious elite that I might say. Have a look at what God says for himself from his word, which is the Bible. Here's one that's really good. I love this. What will be written on your tombstone? And he says, nice try. I love it. That's brilliant. That's brilliant.
Now, see, one of the things that, if I was able to, I would love to question him on some things where he had said, you know, he doesn't believe, or he's not sure if he believes in an afterlife. Well, I would like to know why, because we have things that I think count as evidence toward you know, an existence beyond this life, or so I'd really, because he sounds like he's intelligent. Same kind of thing with, here's where we're getting the same kind of thing where we had with Dio, where he looks at Christianity and he finds some good things about it, but then he wants to chuck the whole thing because of what he thinks or what he takes as, you know, people, certain characters being immoral, really, is what he's saying. You know, he's saying something about Moses. Oh, he's, you know, a freak or whatever. Like, well, why do you think that? What is it that puts you off about him? And if it's a moral thing, well, then we have to get back down to the brass tacks of, you know, where are you getting your morality from? And the whole thing about organization or organized religion, it's like, again, I sort of alluded to this idea earlier. Once you have a concept, you've got an organization. Like, these people are all trying to say they want to get away from organize this and organize that. But once you conceptualize anything, you've got organization at a fundamental level. You can't, there's no way to not be organized in some way, shape, or form. And really what it boils down to, and I did state this explicitly earlier, I'll state it again, is they don't really want diversity. They don't really want this. What they really want is autonomy. They want no one to tell them what to do. They don't want any supposed rules or restrictions applied to their life, and they're more than willing to put those restrictions on you through, by telling you that you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that. It's the ought is problem again. And I mean, we see the inception of this in Genesis 3, you shall be as gods, right? Ye shall be as gods. And that's exactly what human beings, fallen human beings do. They walk around being their own gods, you know? So I agree with some of the things that he's saying when, you know, it depends on what aspect of the organization, you know, when you make the whole thing about the organization, like say, for example, a church who is caught up only in the trappings of the show of the whole thing versus a relationship with God, then yes, I agree with you. But if you get one other person to agree with your beliefs, then you've got your own organized religion right there, you know? And so
the only thing that I was saying though, Brian, and I'll make sure I'm clear, is that I could see where our formal institutionalized religious branches of Christianity, in fact, many others, could be open for some criticism. And you know, I'm a Christian saying that. I get it. I understand where people like him are coming from, and people that are listening right now say, well, you know, I hate you guys. You know, I hate those guys. Well, you know, that's a little bit, maybe that's a bit too harsh, but I think you've got to look past that. My argument has always been, you've got to look past that to the real God. Don't look at the person, look at the God. And the real God that we're talking about can only be found in the Bible. And if you haven't done that, if you haven't, you personally have not given that a good go and say, okay, what is this God thing all about? And open that Bible, right? And hey, for a lot of us, it's really hard to start at the beginning. You know, that Genesis, that can be a bit deep, a bit much. But if you open it up to the New Testament and start at the book of Matthew and just start reading there and just give that a good go before you say that this whole thing is a load of rubbish. And again, I repeat myself, I can see where the organized churches of today could be open for certain amounts of criticism, including some of the churches that I've attended myself. So, you know, I'm not blind to the things that we get wrong.
And Jesus himself, see, this is where, I mean, Anderson says he's not a Christian, so that's fine. I respect his, you know, opinion. I can only go with what he tells me he is or believes. That's fine. But Jesus himself came here and was causing all kinds of trouble with the church. He did work on the Sabbath. And, you know, it's like, this guy, you know, you would think that Anderson would be like, wow, Jesus is pretty cool. He's kind of saying the same thing I am in some respect.
You know? Exactly.
Yeah. Jesus agrees with Tull on, or not Tull. Yeah. You know, that guy that plays the flute, Jethro Tull. No,
yeah.
he agrees with Anderson on a lot of these points, you know? And like you said, and this is just true of any person in any studies we do, we have to critique the worldview from inside the worldview. We can't sit on the outside of the worldview and take pot shots at it. You gotta understand it before you can critique it. You know, it's just not fair. It's not, you know, it's just not fair. And you haven't done your due diligence unless you're able, you know, you understand. Otherwise, you're just going to start making, you know, these straw man assumptions and tearing down things that aren't really what we're trying to say anyway, yeah, as Christians.
Walking through forests of hungry hearts, men scoff at the monkeys who live in their dark tents. Down by the water hole, drunk every Friday, eating their nuts, saving their raisins for Sunday. Lions and tigers who wait in the shadows, they're fast but they're lazy, and sleep in green meadows. Well, that's
so the song that we're talking about that we wanted to roll into now is Bungle in the Jungle off of the 1974 War Child album. This is where I think he's really dialing down onto a deistic or deistic worldview here, because let me just read a few of the things. This one's sort of the most telling, where he says, and a lot of people will be familiar with this song. This would be a song that some people would be familiar with. It had a lot of radio play. Still, to this day, gets a lot of radio play, and it's got the trademark Jethro Tull sounds. When you hear it, you know it's Jethro Tull. But I think Anderson, in the lyrics of this song, he really starts to dial down on something that we would probably call deism or deism, especially in a verse like this one here. It says, "The rivers are full of crocodile nasties, and he who made kittens put snakes in the grass. He's a lover of life, but a player of pawns." Now, see, I think these lyrics are wrong, but I could be wrong. So it says, here it's written, "He's a lover of life, but a player of pawns. Yes, the king on his sunset lies waiting for dawn. To light up his jungle, as play is resumed, the monkeys seem willing to strike up the tune." So the monkeys would be us, obviously, and we're just kind of playing along in this game that this overseer or deistic god has wound up and set and let go for his amusement. But back to the idea of where I think there might be like I said, I'm probably wrong because this is on the internet, right? So this got to be right, these lyrics. It says, "He's a lover of life, but a player of..." Now, for the past, I don't know, I've been listening to this song for over 20 years now, more like over 30 years. I always thought he said, "He's a lover of life, but a player of pawn chess," like moving pieces around on the chessboard.
Yeah. Well, it's still the same. Same.
It's talking sort of like manipulative gameplay from an overseer, deistic type god who just kind of is sitting back and kind of having a laugh or enjoying the whole show of us monkeys down here doing what we do, kind of thing. And there's one aspect of the song that I do like, and I'm assuming that he's including himself as in the idea of being a monkey. But I do like the fact that this puts things in perspective to somewhat, because it knocks man down a notch, you know? And I think that's one of the problems with other, you know, worldviews in general. I mean, I think we talked last time. If we didn't, I don't know. I'm going to bring it up now because we need to start putting this into our episodes. But, you know, worldviews that people are going to hold, they've got to answer at least four questions. Where did we come from? Origin. Where are we going? Destiny. Who am I? And why are we here? And why is there evil, or the problem of evil? And basically, that's just morality. You know, we need to talk about morality in a worldview. Otherwise, these worldviews don't do anything for us. We might as well not hold them if they don't answer these four questions, or they're not complete if they don't answer these four questions, because these are the questions that are the most important to us as human beings. But the problem is, worldviews are going to elevate humans to a high position, a too high of a position, or they're going to degrade humans to too low of a position. So, say in in deism, it not only does, in a weird way, it puts man in his proper place as the created, in the created order versus, you know, the eternal order, which would be God's unique position, but it also then turns man loose to be his own God. And say something like pantheism, which says all is God, well, that puts us all in the same category, and it elevates man too high. So in this song, I like the fact that he's kind of calling us monkeys, you know, like, and I like that because there's a shred of humility in there. And for as arrogant as Anderson might sound sometimes, see, this is the paradox of it all. It's brilliant, but it's like, he makes a claim that he seems to be somewhat agnostic, or at least that he's definitely agnostic about, you know, what happens to us after we die, but he doesn't believe that there's a life after death. So in some ways that's a humble position, but when it becomes arrogant is when you take the revelation that we've received and then you say, no, I'm going to forego the revelation that's been given to us by God, and I'm going to make my own assessment here, and that's when you've raised yourself too high, I think. So for him to write a song like Bungle in the Jungle and talk about, you know, basically this is sort of like a game of chess for, you know, this deistic God who's just kind of having his way with creation, which he is having his way with creation, but in the Judeo-Christian worldview, God doesn't want to just be over us and sort of a manipulative creator, controller. He wants to be in relationship with his creation. He wants to interact with his creation. He wants his creation to, and here back to the order thing, he wants creation, his created order, to view him in the proper position, putting man under him, not in a subjective, tyrannical type way, but in a way that is just proper so that things can function in the way that they ought to. Like you, as a father, you wouldn't want the child, if the child is railing against the parent's authority, well, the child has to be put into its proper place. And when the child just goes on and is content with being a child and living in his proper sphere of order, then things run much smoother. And that's the whole story of the Bible, is God wants to put man back in his proper place, not a bootlicker, so to speak, like he talked about in the one song, but just in relation, in proper relation with God, and then things will operate much more advantageous for even for us as humans. So we want to maximize joy and maximize
minimize pain.
Maximize the advantage. Yeah, minimize pain, then you have to put things in their proper order. And for man to elevate himself to a higher spot than he is, like most notably as elevate himself to the position of God or a God, then things are going to start to go wrong. And that's what we see in society in the front pages of the news every day, you know. So, yeah, didn't mean to go on a rant there. You should have blown the...
Hey, this is Ron Howden from Nectar, and you're listening to Philosopher Rock.
I want to talk a bit more about this War Child album, because I want to talk about a song off it as well, which is really nice. And the interesting part about this War Child album, it was released in 1974, and it does have a bit of a tie-in with our previous show on Ronnie James Dio, in that when they were Jethro Tull, they actually went to the same chateau, the haunted chateau in France, that Rainbow did when they went there to record Long Live Rock and Roll. And did you know that they also had problems when they were recording this there as well? So that place is awful. If you look into the history of the Chateau d'Urville, my French is awful. And as it is, you know, I think I've said this before, but ich spreche ein bisschen Deutsch, but my French is terrible. but I might put a link in the show notes so people can go and find it, because they're not going to find it by my pronunciation. But A lot of the bands that recorded at that chateau in France, you know, we talked about this before, like Elton John and Rainbow and just dozens of others, so many of them had problems there that it sort of got its name as being a haunted chateau, right? Chateau. That's just so the bit of the background for the War Child album. Now, I don't mind this album. It's got one of my favourite Jethro Tull. Surprise, surprise, it's got one of GK's favourite Tull songs on it. And that song is Skating Away on the Thin Ice of a New Day. Now, I'm going to try not to sing this. I do want to share some of the lyrics with you. And, as we're going through this, if you're in front of a computer or tablet or you've got your phone, go and find the lyrics so you can follow along to see what the heck we're rabbiting on about. But let me tell you this first. Here's a confession. I always thought that this song was about Jesus, right? Now, don't laugh. Nobody is allowed to laugh, okay, because this is just my humble opinion. But let me just tell you why. But the very first line, let me read the first four lines and then I'll talk about it. Meanwhile, I'm going to try not to sing it, okay? Meanwhile, back in the year one, when you belonged to no one, you didn't stand a chance, son, if your pants were undone. Now, meanwhile, back in the year one, well, the year one starts with Jesus, right? If it was no Jesus, we wouldn't have a year one, especially when we're talking AD. Now, I know it's probably zero, but just follow along with me. When you belong to no one, that's because we didn't know who he was when he was born. Like, we didn't know, you know. Many people, right. Some did, don't get me wrong. His cousin John, who was in the womb, knew who he was, right? But let's just say we, the general populace, had no idea who he was. And then the very next stanza, because you were bred for humanity. Well, Jesus was bred for our sake. He was sent here and for us all. So I'm just thinking, this is why, I hope you're understanding why I'm thinking this is about Jesus. Because you were bred for humanity and sold to society. One day you'll wake up in the present day, a million generations removed from expectations of being who you really want to be. Now, I'm taking that, you know, there's some thoughts that you might have heard it before, not necessarily from Ian Anderson, but I'm just going to say that Jesus didn't realize who he was. I think if you look at the musical Jesus Christ Superstar, he sort of had to be, this is just my opinion, there's some intimation there where he had to be talked into who he was. And then, oh, okay, I am the Christ, you know. So it might be coming from that viewpoint. I just want to rush down to maybe two-thirds way through the song. To do the things they should have done as you cross the wilderness, there's another reference to Jesus, spinning in your emptiness, if you have to, pray, looking for a sign that the universal minds. I reckon that is another reference to deism.
Yeah, definitely.
Just my opinion. But the universal mind has written you, minds, has written you into the passion play. There was subsequent album called A Passion Play. But the idea of the passion of Jesus, that we might just, I'm just going to rush through this, but it's that short final period in the life of Jesus, say from his triumphal entry into Jerusalem, to his crucifixion and subsequent resurrection, which is what we're celebrating now at Easter, right? Us, we believers, right?
Currently, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And just as by the by, the term passion used here comes from the Latin patior passus sum, so it means to suffer, to bear, endure, and it also became the English words patience or patient, right? But he's talking about being written into a passion play, and that is what happened to Jesus. It was foretold that this was going to happen, right? The coming of Jesus and his birth, death, and resurrection is all prophesied in the what we call the Old Testament, okay? So can you see why I'm arguing here that this is about Jesus?
Yeah, I can see that. I'm glad that you elaborated on all those, because when you originally mentioned it to me, talking about when we were sorting out what songs we were going to do, I didn't see it. Of course, I was taking it the wrong way, because you had said, meanwhile, back in the year one, I thought you were talking about the beginning of time kind of thing. But now I see what you're talking about, the line between BC and AD, so to speak.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, I totally see what you're getting at here. And I see more of your point.
But more important of what I say about this song, why don't we look at some what he said about the song, right? So in an interview in just June 2018, here's what he said. And this still doesn't change my opinion that this isn't partially about Jesus. I just want to reiterate that. He said, this was my first song talking about the issue of ecology, and in this specific case, climate change, because, sorry, I should have said, you know, it goes on about skating away, skating away, skating away on the thin ice of a new day, right? So we're talking about skating away on a thin ice of a new day. That is the crux of the chorus, etc.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So he says that this is his first song about being the issue of ecology, and in this specific case, climate change. Back in those days, scientists believed that we were heading towards a period of global cooling, that we could be heading towards a new ice age. And in fact, they realized that, in fact, no, we're heading toward a period of global warming. So my song became kind of redundant, but the idea was sound. And I still have a fondness for it today because it is talking with optimism about facing the changing world and a changing climate to which we have to adapt bravely and optimistically. And it feels very apt and appropriate for today. Now, War Child came out in 1974. And I'm going to tell you something. This may give us a bit of an insight into Ian Anderson's worldview. We're talking about ecology here and the fact that he believes in the idea of global warming. But around about this time, when I was at school, they were scaring the crud out of us with the coming ice age, right?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
But then we changed to this idea that the planet is now warming up. It's heating up and we're just going to, you know, going to cook to death. And then we thought, we better calm that down a bit and we better just call it climate change. So I don't know, but I just think, let's just take it for what it is. This is what he says it's about. This is what I say it's about. And I do remember them talking about that at school. They were teaching us that. And look, whoosh, bang, we've changed our minds and now we're heating up and we're going to have a bit of climate change. Here, have some of that. But just right now, you know, everyone knows that we're in the middle of this coronavirus pandemic. And this recent interview with him, I just think you might find it interesting or relevant here is his take on the current situation. Now, as I read this, bear in mind, he lives on a working farm. He's been a farmer for many years. And I don't know if you know this, Brian, but in the past, he was also, at one time, he was a salmon farmer up at Strathaird, and that's in the Isle of Skye. Now, just for you, Jethro Tull aficionados, the Isle of Skye gets a mention in the tune Acres Wild as the winged isle. The Isle of Skye, when you look at it from above, it looks like a wing stretched out. So it's called the winged isle, and I'm not going to sing it to you, but it's from the song Acres Wild from the Heavy Horses album, right? So, you know, he loved where he loved the Isle of the Skye, which is right up there above, right up in the top of Scotland there. Would be a great place to visit, I reckon. When my son was in Scotland, I said, oh, did you go to the Isle of Skye? And he said, we came close, but we went somewhere else. Long story, but we'll move on. Here's what he has to say about the COVID outbreak. He said, I don't want to play the blame game, but you know, we should be also learning about the perils of eating stuff that has had a face on it. The ridiculous reliance on flesh eating, which is so prevalent. I am not a strict vegetarian or a vegan, but most of what I eat probably comes under the vegan classification, just because I like the stuff. You know, it's not my business to tell you what to eat, not my business to tell you how many babies to have, but I would like people to try and work it out for themselves, come to their own conclusion, and I think responsibly about themselves, their children, their grandchildren, their neighbours. And those of us who share this finite and fragile resource, the air that we breathe, the food that we eat, the water that we drink, people have to come to responsible conclusions themselves. So you can see there, he's taken to this, the idea of the ecology, climate change, even hinting there, for my money, just for my money, you know, about eating, well, clearly about eating meat, but overpopulation, right? It's not my business to tell you how many babies to have, but think about it, think about what mm-hmm. you're doing. Right. So these are all things that give you an idea. I'm only bringing this up so you get a bit more about his thoughts on life, because that's what we're looking at. What's his viewpoint? Because Brian and I talk a lot about religion, and we're focusing on his religious beliefs. But if you take the time to look at some of a lot of his music, a lot of those, I like to think of them as that middle era albums, the sort of Back to the Land albums. There's a lot of this talk about farming, ecology, looking after the land, and or taking mm-hmm. to the land. Well, think about the song Heavy Horses itself. It's about how the mechanization has taken over from these great traditions where we would use, in harmony with the earth, using animals to sow our crops and, you know, and to eat and to live. And now we've come full on technology based. And so everybody who criticizes where we are now, I'm happy for you to all throw your mobile phones away, throw them all away, throw that router away, get rid of the internet, get rid of the TVs, and go back to the land, because I think it's a great idea for some of you to do that. And I can hear the flute.
That's the sound of the flute.
All right, okay, so let's move on. So that's a couple of songs from War Child. Now, the last song that I want to cover here is from one of the absolute best albums. There are a few fantastic albums of Jethro Tull's, in my humble opinion. You know, you've got Aqualung, you've got Heavy Horses, and you've got this one album here is called Songs from the Wood. I absolutely love this album. And the song we're going to talk about is Solstice Bells. But there's this trilogy, what they call a trilogy of albums in this 1977, around that era. You've got Songs from the Wood, Heavy Horses and Stormwatch. They come out one after the other, and they're all that thing we've been talking about. They're all the ones that they discuss those folky ideas of Back to the Land. Now, I think this was the era that he moved on to his farm in, but don't quote me, but I think that's what it was. So we have this idea of getting back to the land, getting back in touch with the land, and exploring themes of Britishness. It's absolutely about that, and Britishness, and even touching on paganism, which is a big part of British and European history, right, is paganism. There's nothing new under the sun. And I am tending towards, and I will share with you some lyrics. So Songs from the Wood, 1977 album, and the song is Solstice Bells. Now, that should give you some idea. I want to read you some lyrics right here. So now is the solstice of the year. Winter is the glad song that you hear. Seven maids move in seven time. Have the lads up ready in a line. Ring out these bells. Ring solstice bells. Ring solstice bells. Join together neath the mistletoe by the holy oak whereon it grows. Seven druids dance in seven time. Sing the song the bells call loudly chiming. So we're talking about the winter solstice. We're singing about dancing druids. And praise be to the distant sister sun, joyful as the silver planets run. Again, seven maids move in seven time. Sing the song the bells call loudly chiming. Ring out these bells. Now, let me read. I'll put this in the show notes, but just so we know what the solstice specifically is. And most of what you'll find online is northern hemispheric centric, okay? You guys up there think you guys run everything, and the southern hemisphere, you know, there's just a few people down there wandering around, walking around upside down.
Hey, Garth, I just got to stop you real quick because it was really weird. You used the word centric right as I was writing it down in a note to talk about that.
I love it when things like that
happen. Exactly when you said the words.
I love it when that happens. You know how often that happens to me? Yeah, I love it. So you guys up there in the, you know, the northern hemisphere, you guys think that, okay, yeah, those people down there in South Africa and New Zealand and Australia, we're just all down here walking around upside down, picking our feet, you know, and I'm not doing much else. But I can tell you there's a whole other world down here. But going back to where I started, so most of the information you find out about these things is based on the Northern Hemisphere. The December solstice happens at the same instant for everyone everywhere on the earth. And this year, the winter solstice occurs on Sunday, December 22. I'm not sure what year this is, but we'll just take it as it's usually either the 21st or the 22nd of December. The winter solstice happens every year when the sun reaches its most southerly declination of minus 23.4 degrees. In other words, it is when the North Pole is tilted farthest away from the sun, delivering the fewest hours of sunlight of the year. The sun is directly overhead of the Tropic of Capricorn in the southern hemisphere. Yay, we get a mention. Yeah, I've crossed the Tropic of Capricorn many times. The sun is directly overhead of the Tropic of Capricorn in the southern hemisphere during the December solstice and is closer to the horizon than at any other time in the year, meaning shorter days and longer nights. The day after the winter solstice marks the beginning of the lengthening of days leading up to the summer solstice in June. In the southern hemisphere, the opposite is true. Dawn comes early and dusk comes late. The sun is high and the shortest noontime shadow of the year happens there. Well, that's not there, mate. That's here. In the southern hemisphere, people will experience their longest day and shortest night. So we're the opposite. Pagan and Druid celebrations continue at places like Stonehenge at this time each year. I'm going to ask you to go and look at the links I'm going to drop in for more details and listen to the album, the Jethro Tull album, Songs from the Wood in particular. There's songs on there, even the titles will give it away. Jack and the Green, great song, but it's all about like a, well, okay, let's say just the pixie-like character, the Jack and the Green. You've got Cup of Wonder, and then you can also then listen to also the albums Heavy Horses and Stormwatch, although Songs from the Wood is more clearly based on those sort of things. In relation to this, there will be some people will be thinking, well, the Christian church has adapted some of those pagan celebrations, you know, especially since this solstice happens around the time that we celebrate Christmas, right? I would disagree. Now, this is not the episode to go into that much too deeply, but I would disagree. I think there's a clear line between paganism and the Christian events of Christmas and Easter. But I will just include this just for something for us all to think about again. So we get a bit of a, we're trying to zero in on Ian Anderson here. Okay. And this is an interview that's not that long ago. Again, it'll be in the show notes. Generally speaking, however, so this is Ian Anderson. Generally speaking, however, the Anglican Church is pretty easygoing. I play in churches regularly in support of great medieval churches and cathedrals. I'm a big supporter of Christianity and the physicality of the church, but I don't call myself a Christian. However, that doesn't seem to cause a problem with the more liberal-thinking Christians that I work with. I mean, they all hope that I'm going to come out of the closet one day and say, that's it, yeah, I really am a Christian after all, but I'm not going to do that. And so I just threw that in there because in my mind that was trying to share with you how I think a possibility, it might be a distinct one, where how he's maybe tying in, you know, those pagan celebrations that he sings about, especially in this Ring Out Solstice Bells, and maybe his view on the church that maybe, you know, okay, I might be drawing a long bow here, that, you know, maybe that has something to do with the Christian calendar as well. There goes, I can hear the flute right now, and I'll pull the pin on that song. So there you go. So that's the six songs we've done, and I've given you a few things to think about.
Yeah, I'd like to say a quick, just one little comment on the idea of the sort of occultic pagan imagery that's going on and for sure songs from the Wood. But it's for a person who, and I'm talking about Ian Anderson, for a person who eschews the idea of ordinances, you know, through the church and sort of the pomp and circumstance of it all, we sure do see a lot of the same thing in the occult realm. You know, we see the same kind of rituals, you know, it's all about rituals and winding up these gods, right? I mean, I'm not suggesting that he is an occultist. I mean, in the sense that he's practicing ritualistic magic, but I mean, we see the same types of things in the pagan realm as we do in the Christian realm. And I think it's because of where man is. We're in a position of, you know, well, what does the Bible say? Paul says that we see through a glass darkly, you know. So we're reaching out, trying to get help, or what's the word I'm looking for? We're trying to invoke, that's the word I'm trying to look for, trying to invoke someone in the supernatural realm or someone somewhere to help us or to give us guidance. And, you know, God, the God of the Bible, Yahweh, the Christian God, Judeo-Christian God, wants us to appeal to him versus any of these other entities. So I think it's a little bit ironic that Anderson is, you know, appealing to these ideas of, and kind of celebrating these pagan ideas, which are really, honestly, the similar, very similar to what happens in the Christian church. But, you know, he doesn't seem to have a problem with those types of rituals. It's just, honestly, I think at the end of the day, and I guess if we're winding toward the end here, which I believe that we are, that we're going to find that once again, it's just a matter of, in his case, holding himself too high in the hierarchy of creation. He wants to have more of like the autonomy that I was talking about earlier. And when I was writing the word centric down right as you were actually speaking it, which was very creepy, not, I guess it's not creepy, it's just very odd, but I think that these worldviews are too man-centric. They're putting man as the center. And I think that's just the problem with them. And now, because of our fallen nature, that's what we tend to do, is put ourselves as the center, make ourselves the center. And that's just, like I said, it's due to our fallenness and our sin nature that turns ourselves inward on ourselves and really ultimately causes all of our problems. And that is, again, stems from Adam and Eve's rebellion against God. And the whole project of God and Jesus and the Bible is to disabuse us of that idea and to get us outward focused on God versus focusing in on ourselves, which, you know, again, the idea of taking up our cross and dying to ourselves. We don't want to eliminate ourselves, which some worldviews do that. That puts us too low on the rung in the hierarchy. We're important and we matter. We have a function and a place in God's creation. It's just not at the top, and it's just not at the bottom either. So that's what the Bible is trying to get across to us. So go.
Yep. Look, Brian, we are winding up now, and I've really enjoyed this discussion. Just a couple more things to cover before we move on. What was your take on my take of what deism is? Was I close to the mark?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, it's essentially it's man-centered. It claims there's no revelation from God, so ultimately it's relativistic. And the whole, it's subjective, and it suffers from problems that stem from those type of, which I talked about earlier, self-refuting, and if we're a part of creation, then, you know, we were created with moral intuitions. The whole ought is dilemma, it can't be avoided. And the idea that how, you know, deism wants to dictate that all that we can know is what we can see through the created order. That, like, again, there's been no revelation, but how are they able to make that claim? That how do they know that this God that they actually say exists, how can they say that that God hasn't, universally hasn't given us any revelation, especially if someone came here and said that it did, died on a cross, is a historical figure, and claimed to be that God? How are these deists able to make the claim that, you know, we can't know certain things? I mean, you know, that if you come to me and tell me, oh, you can't know that, I mean, how do you know I can't know it? You know, you're just elevating yourself above me, which is exactly the problem with this worldview. So you did get it right, yeah. And I think we've sort of fleshed it out through this entire...
We've weaved in and out, haven't we, as we've gone along. And I'll just let you know, we've gone over 3 hours. We've done it again. We said we'll try and do a shorter one, but we'll make this 2 parts. So I'm going to just finish up here, and I'm going to say that in my personal opinion, I think that his worldview is deist, and it's between deism and pantheism, right? It's somewhere there. And he is also a big believer in looking after the planet, ecology, right? He clearly believes that climate change is an issue, and we all know that that stems from the people that are from that viewpoint. That's a man-caused phenomena. But in my humble opinion, I've long believed that he is a deist. Just my opinion, and it doesn't really matter what I believe, to be totally honest. It's just my opinion. What do you think?
I agree with you and on every point. The only thing that I would add is the fact that, as with any other worldview other than Christianity, they're going to end up smuggling in Christian, the facets of the Christian worldview, because the Christian worldview is, in my opinion, I think it really is a description of reality, the way that reality is. So because they live in that reality, because all these people, these rock stars or whoever, because all of us live in the same reality, no matter what we espouse or what we say, you know, what our worldview is, we still end up smuggling in and importing things from the Christian worldview, because it is truly the real version of reality. So, you know, you get things like the morals that they want to smuggle in, and you get things like Ian Anderson saying that he likes Christianity, but he's not going to call himself a Christian, because it can't be avoided. You know, he has to. It really is the foundation. Christianity really is the foundation, and all the rest of the things are the aberrations. And so in order for him to even function in reality, he has to acknowledge some of it, and that's where you get these leanings or these smatterings and pictures and glimpses of the Christian worldview coming through. So, yeah, I agree with you.
Okay. All right, well, we'll leave it there, Brian. That was fantastic. Listen, All right, we'll finish there, Brian, but before you go, I've got a question for you. In another podcast show that I used to be on, I used to always ask my co-host, I used to say, what are you reading this week? So I just want to ask you, Brian, what's been on your turntable this week?
My turntable. Well, let me think. It sounds self-serving, but it's the truth, as I've just been mixing down a new project, so I've been listening to that repeatedly, my own music. So let me think if there's anything that I've been... Well, Jethro Tull, obviously. went back to and scanned through the catalog of that, because I wanted to familiarize myself. And I want to say thank you for suggesting this, Ian Anderson and Jethro Tull, because it kind of reminded me of how much I really like the stuff that I hadn't, you know, pulled out in a while and listened to. So there's that, and of course I've been I bought some vinyl, a whole stack of vinyl I haven't got to yet, but that's hopefully maybe I'll get to play some of that tonight. So yeah, that's pretty much the extent of what I've been listening to. I did hear a band that I wasn't familiar with called the Revivalists. I heard them the other day, so I kind of looked them up and playing some of their songs, and I kind of like them. They're not like, they don't blow me away, but I do. They were interesting enough for me to look up their material. So Garth, what's on your turntable?
Well, this week I've been listening to Wishbone Ash, the album Live in Paris, on Spotify. Should I be saying that? Oh, well, plug for Spotify. Wishbone Ash Live in Paris, 2015. Absolutely brilliant live album. I think the mark of any band is their ability to play their music live. And if you really like live music and you like, you know, prog rock with twin lead guitars, lots of harmony guitars I absolutely love, and you like it live, go and listen to Wishbone Ash Live in Paris.
Yeah, that sounds cool. Hopefully this coronavirus will be done so I can see them, actually see them live.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, that's right.
Not that that's why I want the coronavirus to end. I want people to be healthy, but
right.
But it would be just a little icing on the cake if I could actually see the concert that I got for a rotation.
Absolutely before, so. Brilliant. Great. All right. Well, you'll have to let us know how that goes in the future. All right. Well, Brian, thanks for your time. It was a great show. I enjoyed doing that with you, and we'll come back and we'll do something else next time.
Yes, thank you. It was a pleasure to not only co-host with you, but like I said, just diving back into these old classic tunes that – that I really do love and kind of maybe forgotten about. And I think we had a great talk, so thanks for the opportunity.
All right, Brian, hooroo, mate.
Happy trails to you, Garth.
Meanwhile, back in the year one, when you belonged to no one, you didn't stand a chance, son. If your pants were undone, 'cause you were brave for humanity and sold to society. One day you'll wake up in the present day, a million generations removed from expectations of being who you really want to be. Skating away, skating away, skating away on the thin ice of a new day.